So my title, my talk this evening, and when Father Shafkin first invited me to give a lecture about the Middle Ages, one of the things that he wanted me to do was simply to lay out, you know, some of the many contributions that the Middle Ages have made to the enduring legacy of Western civilization, to European and North American societies and culture in ways that have redounded down through the centuries, over against what he's absolutely right about tends to be a sort of stereotype about the Middle Ages, in which they're regarded as really best forgotten, and it would be good if they had never existed at all. But I said to him, you know, I think it could be more helpful if I address some of these issues by talking partly about those stereotypes themselves. What kinds of images are at play when we're talking about a very positive, kind of exaggerated counter-image of the Middle Ages on the one hand, or a denigratory, dismissive view on the other? And that's why my title is rather cumbersome, long, but meant to convey that, which is the Middle Ages, : Eight Dark Ages of Superstitious Backwardness, rolls right off the tongue, doesn't it? Golden Age of Catholic Harmony, or neither? Hint, I'm going to go for the neither. All right. My main area of scholarly expertise, as Father Shafkin mentioned, is the Reformation era, the 16th and the 17th centuries in Western Europe. But that world begins very much in the late Middle Ages. And so in order to understand the world that I'm principally interested in, the 16th and the early 17th centuries, it's absolutely crucial to understand what was going on prior to that. Namely, late medieval Christianity is crucial for understanding both the Protestant and the Catholic Reformations of the 16th century. And so, although I am not, and I don't claim to be, I would never assert, and my medievalist colleagues they would jump all over me if they knew that I was saying I'm a medievalist as well. I have been reading and writing and thinking about the late Middle Ages for, to some extent, the predecessor period to my own particular area of interest for really going on 30 years now. So I'm legit to that extent, even though my specialty is not the Middle Ages. I didn't want anybody to think I was coming here under false pretenses. So, my remarks tonight are going to be about the Middle Ages in Western Europe, but they're also, as I said, going to be about the place that they occupy in large-scale, long-term historical narratives. These are the kinds of narratives about change over centuries that tend to stand at the stated or unstated core of popular conceptions. The kind of narratives of history and historical change that people have, even though they don't always, they're not always aware that they have them. To the extent that Americans even have a historical conception, which is a whole other issue. To some extent, they're also, in some ways, the kind of bedrock or the framework of textbook historical accounts about the sweep of history over the past half millennium or millennium. But most of all, I think, they constitute a kind of polemical image that's really more about using a sometimes radically distorted view of the past in order to link it to or to defend certain ideas or to further an agenda in the present. So I'm concerned tonight not only with, you're getting like two or three lectures in one. It's not only about the Middle Ages themselves, it's also about uses and abuses of images of the Middle Ages, connotations of the Middle Ages for ideological, polemical purposes in the present. One of the responsibilities that professional historians have, it seems to me, is to guard against this kind of use and abuse, to call out distortions and polemical uses of history based on our years of reading and thinking and analyzing and writing, based on, you don't want to know how much reading. Thousands of sources, literally thousands of sources written by, in my case, or the case of medieval historians, people who lived many centuries ago. If historians don't do this, if we don't call out the distortions and the misleading interpretations and the misuses of past images, nobody's going to do it because nobody else has the time or the training to do it. So we're the guardians, among other things. See, this is our socially useful purpose. Historians are the ones who say, hey, you know what, that is absolutely not how it was, and I know because I've read more than you have, and here's a better understanding because we have better evidence and interpretation. So one of the things I'd like you to take away from this evening is that the actual lived human past, the subject matter of history, in almost every time and place, the Middle Ages is just one example, the actual lived human past was almost always much more complicated, much messier, and much more difficult to generalize about than the way in which those times and places are typically portrayed in popular images. And that goes for whether the images and the portrayals are, in the generalizations, are either positive or negative. The actual human past, almost always more complicated and messier than the images of times and places in the past. All right, then, the basic structure of my comments this evening, here's the signposting part of the lecture, is as follows. Three main parts I'm going to talk about. The first thing I'm going to talk about is what seems to me the common dominant image about the Western Latin Middle Ages in our time and place here in the United States. To some extent, I think this is also true of Western Europe. Namely, as a backward, superstitious, ignorant, oppressive, and intellectually stagnant because religiously repressive era between the fall of the Roman Empire in the late 5th century and the beginning of modernity with the first beginnings of the Renaissance in the 14th century, the Reformation of the 16th century, the Enlightenment of the 17th, the 18th centuries, a period that was dominated with ill effects by the Catholic Church and its clergy. In effect, the Middle Ages is regarded as the Dark Ages that had to be cast off before the progress of the modern era could begin. And so the encouraged or implicit response that somebody's supposed to have to an image of the Middle Ages like this is, what, good riddance, you know? Thank goodness I wasn't born then. What would it be? Awful period, a terrible thing. I'm going to elaborate then a bit on this image and talk about a few things that's problematic with it. Then I'll move to a second, less common, a kind of minority Catholic counterimage, I will call it, about the same period, the Western Middle Ages, as an era of enormous faith and piety, a world characterized by a kind of organic, harmonious society, permeated by common Christian beliefs and values rooted in the Catholic Church. This is an ordered world in which life was simpler, more meaningful, and more secure than it has become in the modern period. In effect, this sees the Middle Ages as a golden age that has been lost through the regrettable rejections of the Church by the Reformation, the Enlightenment, modern philosophy, modern institutions. In short, here, the Middle Ages are meant to evoke a sense, a kind of nostalgic yearning for a better, bygone world that has been tragically lost. I'll say a few things more about this image and also what is problematic about it. And then finally, the third part of my talk, I'll say something more about what it seems to me is really going on when images of the Middle Ages are invoked like this. Concentrating in my comments on the dominant, the Middle Ages as the Dark Ages cartoon, as I'll call it, how it's been employed and being employed in the service of current commitments, current causes linked to a basic dichotomous binary view of history. It's meant to justify and validate the present. It's not concerned with really trying to understand medieval persons and their world in ways that they would recognize. So first then, Dark Ages of superstitious backwardness. First part. Not a single medieval historian I have ever known in my career would ever regard the Middle Ages as the Dark Ages. And yet this image and stereotype persist in the broader culture. Despite the tracing of the persistent, albeit diminished, influence of ancient Roman imperial institutions and practices and patterns of life for centuries, in one way or another, after the classic date for the fall of Rome, which is 476. In this portrayal, it's as if society and culture fell into a kind of sinkhole for 1,000 years, with little, if anything, to admire and much, if not everything, to criticize and condemn. So what are some of the main features of this image of the Middle Ages? One of the images is the church, which essentially people, or those who invoke the image, mean the clergy. This is actually a side note. This is a common, it's a common inaccuracy in the ways that people use the term the church. And they forget about the vast majority, numerically, of the church in every period has been the laity. Right? So the church includes the laity. But when people invoke the church in the Middle Ages in this negative stereotype, what they really mean typically is the clergy. The church, through the clergy, supposedly controlled everything. It's like a Soviet-style totalitarianism projected back in time. And invariably, you will find an invocation of the Inquisition emphasized here, right? How many people have ever heard something like this, right? You know what I'm talking about? Yeah, absolutely, got it. Technology, unbelievably primitive, didn't change much for hundreds of years. Almost everyone led lives of crushing poverty. What little wealth there was radically unequal in its distribution, controlled by rulers, class aristocratic, and church elites. Classical learning, the classical learning of the ancient world, was lost. It was even actively suppressed by the church, that is, the clergy, which sought deliberately to keep ordinary people ignorant so that they could remain in control. The church was anti-intellectual, it was opposed to science and knowledge, and superstition was everywhere. That's the stereotype, that's the image. How many people have heard something like this before? You all know what I'm talking about, right? Okay. The whole talk wouldn't have made much sense if I'd gotten that wrong. Let's start with this, problems with this. What's wrong with this? First of all, because of the technological limitations on very basic realities relating to communications, relating to travel, there was no way, absolutely no way, for the church or any other institution for that matter to exercise anything like the control of modern democratic states, even in the ancient or the medieval or the early modern eras. The U.S. today and other Western democracies are infinitely more surveillant and regulatory than the medieval church ever was or could be, even at the height of its power and influence in the early 13th century, let's say the pontificate of Innocent III, who had the good sense to approve the Dominican order, along with the Franciscans. Can't forget the Franciscans. In fact, the vast majority of human life in all of its aspects throughout the Middle Ages and into the early modern period is much more locally focused. It's much more particular, focused on local, specific communities than is human life in the world of modern nation states. And this continues, by the way, long beyond the Middle Ages. It's not really until the 19th century that that fundamentally local, particularistic character of human life begins to change in a dramatic way. And a side note here on the Inquisition. There were inquisitorial practices in the Middle Ages, starting in the 12th century. They were commissioned typically by individual bishops in their diocese, and that included the Bishop of Rome, the Pope. But there was no standing, established institution called the Inquisition in the Middle Ages. There were inquisitorial practices that came and went as bishops thought there was a problem with people spreading false beliefs, heresy in the Middle Ages, in which case people would be interrogated and those who refused to recant their views would be punished. But the fact of the matter is, this is an image meant to evoke a visceral emotional reaction. Simply say the word Inquisition and people think, right? Better, it's like written with vampire, you know, typography, dripping with blood, hopefully, right? You could maybe animate it now with all the cool, you know, digital technology that you could do. There's a Spanish Inquisition separately that is established as an institution in the late 15th century in Spain, controlled by the Spanish crown. There's a Roman Inquisition, specifically under papal control in the 16th century, that's very much a response to concern about the Protestant Reformation. Incidentally, though, the scholars who really actually work on the Roman Inquisition have shown that it was, at the time, compared to the other sorts of state judicial procedures that were going on in the 16th century, it was the most sophisticated and the most progressive in terms of the way that it interpreted evidence, the way that it treated witnesses, and so forth. So if you want to really tell a genealogy about modern judicial procedures and where some of those progressive ideas came from, Roman Inquisition. Who knew, right? Some historians know. Hasn't yet percolated to the popular level. All right. In the Middle Ages, was technology primitive compared to today? Yes. Oh, gosh, good thing we got that out of the way, right? But come on, I mean, you know, technology before World War II was primitive compared to today, right? To say nothing of the 19th century. But, you know, anyone who fairly considers something like the building techniques used to construct medieval cathedrals or the practices and the processes that were required to turn raw wool or linen or flax or silk into sometimes astonishing, a beautiful fabric, or the virtuosity that was demanded to make paper by hand that was involved in glass blowing or, say, metalworking like gold or silver. Gold and silver. Up on the charts. I knew there'd be a connection. Very good. Or the creation and the use of movable type and the printing press, right? This is a late medieval invention. Gutenberg was in the German city of Mainz, invented in the 1450s. These are just a few examples. If you consider these things, there's absolutely no fair way you can say that technology was primitive in the Middle Ages. Technology can only be a function of the knowledge of nature as it's known in a given period. We can't have technology that's based on a knowledge of nature we don't yet have, any more than people in the Middle Ages could have done so on the basis of a knowledge of nature that they didn't have. And I think considering what was known, medieval builders and craftsmen and artisans and artists and printers did impressively well. It's absolutely not the case that this was a static or a stagnant world, absent of change. Western Europe by 1500 has been dramatically changed. It's been dramatically altered in terms of its built environment, its existing technologies, its economic practices, the shape and the size and the character of its cities, compared to, for example, when Charlemagne was crowned the Holy Roman Emperor in the year 800. Medieval human lives at all social levels, whether rich or poor, were closely tied to the annual agricultural cycle. When harvests were good, there was enough food for everyone. But when they weren't, those who were the most vulnerable, the low end of the socioeconomic hierarchy, faced starvation. It was a materially austere world for the vast majority of the population. But again, this is not distinctive of or unique to the Middle Ages. It remains true of Western Europe deep into the 19th century, long past the beginning of the Enlightenment and into the period of industrialization. And moreover, starting with the commercial revolution of the 11th century already, we see a major upturn in trade, in the growth of cities, an increase in the population. There's a monetization of economic exchange, an increase in the amount of currency that's actually in use that facilitates commerce, and there's a growth in prosperity. And frankly, after the cataclysm of the Black Death in the middle of the 14th century, there's an increase in that prosperity because the wealth that's around is distributed among many fewer people. Take away half the population, you got the same amount of wealth. Guess what? There's a net doubling for everybody else who's around. Now, it's not equally distributed, but it's not equally distributed in our own day as well. The period from around 1350, right after the Black Death, to the middle of the 15th century, 1450, is actually one of the best for the humbler sorts of people in the late Middle Ages. As for the condemnation of the radical inequalities of wealth, this is sometimes invoked in the negative portrayal of the Middle Ages. This argument, it seems to me, had a bit more plausibility by way of contrast with our own times before the last 40 years of neoliberalism had done their work in the United States. So, for example, in Florence, in Italy, in the year 1427, 10% of the population owned 68% of the wealth. 10% of the population owned 68% of the wealth. Today in the United States, well under 1% owns over 50%. So, the current distribution of wealth in the United States is significantly more unequal than it was in late medieval Europe. And so which society is the more unjust in terms of the distribution of its resources? Score one for the Middle Ages. Another aspect of this image pertaining to the inheritance from the classical world and its attitude and practices with respect to knowledge. It's true that much of the inheritance of classical learning was lost in the centuries after the fall of the Roman Empire, but what remained and was known in the Middle Ages was highly valued, whether we're talking in Benedictine monasteries from the 6th century on, or in cathedral schools and universities, another medieval invention, with the recovery of Aristotle starting in the 12th and then more in the 13th centuries. Medieval intellectuals were keen to make the best knowledge that they had, namely the corpus of Aristotle's works. And that's why they made it the structuring foundation, the basis for the university curriculum throughout European universities starting in the 13th century. It's a mistake, I think about the Renaissance as a distinct, separate period of its own, a period that follows the Middle Ages. It's a name, rather, for a series of trends, cultural and intellectual developments in the late Middle Ages. The Renaissance is overlaid on and is part of the late Middle Ages. That includes Renaissance humanism, starting in the late 13th and the 14th century, spreading throughout Europe in the 15th, and augmenting, enriching, sometimes clashing with scholasticism. Renaissance humanism was absolutely not some sort of neo-pagan, anti-Christian movement that sought to recover ancient learning and use it against the church. This is a legacy of a very important and, at the time, in the 19th century, influential and impressive work by the Swiss historian Jakob Burckhardt, The Civilization of the Renaissance in Italy. That was the main thesis of his work. Using classical learning, whether Ciceronian rhetoric or Platonic philosophy or knowledge of the Greek and Hebrew languages, the point was to try to renew the church and Christianity and society and Christian practice. This is especially, reaches a kind of particular culmination in Northern Europe at the very beginning of the 16th century with Erasmus of Rotterdam. The center for Renaissance humanism, of all things, in the 15th century is nothing else but the papal court. The popes hire the best Renaissance humanists to come and make use of these scholarly tools at their own behest. Monasteries, far from being opposed to the Renaissance, are among the most important nurseries for humanism in the 15th century, not only in Italy, but also in Germany. In the Middle Ages, the most valuable knowledge is not knowledge of ancient texts and authors or knowledge of the natural world, but rather knowledge of God's self-revelation in history, above all in the life and the teaching and the death and the resurrection of Christ, as it had been handed down, that is, through tradition. That's the meaning, right, of tradition. Tradere is to hand over or pass down. The way in which knowledge of God's incarnation in Christ had been handed down by and through the church, through the understanding, the interpretation, the teachings, and the endeavors to live out what was conveyed in God's word in Scripture. All other knowledge had its place, but it was supposed to be positioned in relationship to and was supposed to serve the kinds of varied participations that all baptized Christians ideally had through the firsthand participation in the practice of the virtues, in imitation of Christ, in community, as a kind of foretaste and a hope for eventual eternal life. All other knowledge has a place. It's all part of the pursuit and the understanding of the truth about God's creation, but it is subordinate to this knowledge. This is the knowledge that's absolutely crucial and central in medieval culture. And so it really is, I mean, I don't know quite how to say it, except that it's absurd to regard the medieval church as having been opposed to learning, knowledge, or science. Science here understood in the popular modern sense of knowledge of the natural world. No one who actually reads medieval theology or philosophy or political thought could walk away with this opinion, which I guess is a indirect indicator that not many people who claim this read such texts. It's a view, really, that's very often little more than an extension of anti-religious prejudice, sometimes specifically anti-Catholic prejudice, and often also a presumed incompatibility between religion and science in the whole. The idea, though, that there's a kind of perpetual or intrinsic opposition between religion on the one hand and science on the other is a polemical invention of the 19th century. And I hate to say it, I know I sound like a professorial snob and condescending elitist, but because so few Americans know enough about the past, they fall prey to the myths of the new atheists and to very good cognitive psychologists, but absolutely dreadful historians like Steven Pinker, who's just published a dreadful book, Don't Read It, unless you want to laugh. I mean, it's just bad. It's terrible. It's just a joke, really. He's a terrible historian. And his book, Enlightenment Now, is an absolute epitome. It's one of the reasons why I wanted to do this talk this way. I had this in my mind. It's the epitome of this trading on,
you want to bring up Sam Harris while you're at it?
Sam Harris, you go right down to Daniel Dennett. I mean, we could just go down the, It's you know, Dawkins, these guys, when they get outside of their scholarly specialties, they are fools. A book to read, if you really want to read a good book, shortish, on the historical relationship of what we mean by religion and science over the long, from the ancient world all the way to the present, it's only a couple hundred pages, is Peter Harrison, The Territories of Science and Religion. Terrific book on this. He's an Australian historian, specifically intellectual historian, and who specializes in the history of the relationship between Christianity and science. Anyway, enough of all that. I could go on. You probably get the idea. It's like, come on, Professor Gregory. We all have places to go afterward. I'm happy to take up any of these points. Don't get me going on the new atheists, though, because it will quickly spiral out of control on my part. Okay, so far for the negative stereotype, right? Dark ages. What about the reverse view? If the idea that the Middle Ages was an era of superstitious backwardness doesn't hold up, it's not supported by fair consideration or responsible interpretation of relevant evidence, what about the opposite view, which has traditionally had and still has its supporters among some Catholics, as it did among many 19th century romantics, right, who look back to the Middle Ages for inspiration? It also has a certain cachet still among some critics of modernity as such. Namely, the view the Middle Ages was a golden age of Catholic harmony until the modern era came and wrecked everything. What are some of the, elaborate a little bit more on this. What are some of the features of this depiction? In contrast, right, to modern chaos, modern confusion, modern disruption, modern social dislocation, the Middle Ages was an era in which Christianity infused and ordered all of life, in which society was an organic whole. It was like St. Paul's metaphor of the body from 1 Corinthians 12. The body in which all the parts cooperate for the sake of, in this case, the social body and the common good. This is what, in this view, right, the Latin Middle Ages was like in practice, in actual practice. In place of secular self-assertion, relativistic individualism of the modern world, in the Latin Middle Ages, everyone knew their place and was content with it. The church's authority provided clear lines of conduct, a way of framing all of human life, framing shared practices, structuring the interactions among institutions. There were fewer problems, there were fewer uncertainties, and there was greater range and sense of human fulfillment and flourishing. Now the foot's got to drop on the other hand, right? Historians wreck everything, because we know stuff about the past. Just like the Dark Ages cartoon, right? The Dark Ages cartoon, right, ignores evidence that contravenes its depiction of the Middle Ages, so too does the Golden Age cartoon. The Middle Ages didn't have modern forms of confusion, disruption, and social dislocation, and that simply follows from the fact that it wasn't modern. That's why we call it medieval. But it certainly had its own forms. High levels of violence in everyday life, really in ways that we would find astonishing. Feuds, arguments, public fights, recurrent agricultural subsistence crises, to which I alluded briefly before already, in which people starved to death. The Great Famine in the late 1310s and early 1320s killed between 5 and 10% of the population in northern Europe. And that was just a warm-up for what I mentioned before, too, the Black Death. Between 1347 and 1351, it killed at least a third, and maybe over 50% of the population of Western Europe. Could you imagine if we had an anthrax virus, right, or Ebola outbreak or something like that, and it killed 150 million Americans in 3 or 4 years? That's a demographic disaster. There was a lack of knowledge of the natural world that led people to think that when things like this happened, right, they were being punished directly by God, or that God was simply vengefully capricious. I mean, why, after all, would, right, religious communities often suffer the worst at the hands of the Black Death? Bubonic plague hits an enclosed community of people in close contact with one another. It wasn't unusual for an entire religious community to be dead within a month. Why would God be doing this? Well, he must be vengeful and capricious, or else we're sinful. Right? We're much more sinful than we thought that they were. Examples of unsettling social disruption earlier in the Middle Ages, too. An example. The response of the most dedicated, serious Christians to the emergence of the increase in commerce starting in the 11th century. How do they respond? Run for the hills. Let's get out of here. Get out of the cities. Let's imitate the ancient Egyptian desert fathers. That's what the new hermits like Peter Damian do, for example. In the 12th century, the same kind of reaction is expressed in the formation of new contemplative monastic orders. The Carthusians, the Cistercians, the Premonstratensians. That's their reaction to a period of rapid change, a sense of dislocation, a confusion about what's going on with the economic transformations that are causing social anxiety and political conflicts. Probably the biggest mistake that's made with respect to this counter-cartoon, the Middle Ages as the Golden Age, is a confusion between ideals on the one hand and lived realities on the other. A confusion between prescriptions and practices. Actual medieval society was not a social, political, cultural, economic externalization of the beautifully ordered thought of St. Thomas Aquinas. And it is beautifully ordered. Spend some time seriously with it. Get comfortable with the Aristotelian categories, otherwise it's going to be weird. But once you do, it's an amazing thing. Medieval society, as it was actually lived, was filled with sins and sinners of all sorts, filled with avarice and greed, envy and pride, anger and hatred, competition, resentment, selfishness. That's one of the reasons why medieval saints stand out the way that they do. Otherwise, it would be, check out the Middle Ages. Everybody was a saint. Not so much. And indeed, a great deal of what is, I think, fairly regarded, even on the terms of Christianity at the time as superstitious practice, was widespread. I mean, I assume that Father Shapkin would not approve, for example, people stealing consecrated hosts from the tabernacle, grinding them up and, you know, sprinkling them on your garden to make sure that the crops... People did things like that in the Middle Ages, and all kinds of other stuff, too. We also shouldn't make the mistake of thinking that descriptions of such sins and superstitions and so forth applied to the laity, but not to the clergy, or perhaps to some parish clergy, but not the members of religious order. There were endemic complaints about the clergy and members of religious orders for centuries in the Middle Ages, certainly from no later than the 11th century on in a sustained way. And the most common complaint about the clergy in the Middle Ages, both by other members of the clergy and by the laity, this increases as the Middle Ages goes on, the 11th to the 12th, 13th, and up to the 15th and early 16th centuries. The most common complaint is about their greed. These guys always trying to squeeze more money out of the laity, whether in terms of taxations, extra exactions, a fee for this. Oh, you want this? Your confession at this time instead, that'll be an extra such and such. They're always trying to squeeze the clergy for more, both in the religious orders and among the parish clergy and bishops in their diocese. There are, of course, famous, notorious examples of this at the highest levels of the papal court in Avignon in the 14th century, the late 15th and early 16th century, right, the juiciest examples of all in the Renaissance popes. I mean, you know you've got a problem when your Franciscan pope, Sixtus IV, in 1471 spends one third of the annual papal income on his coronation tiara. That's not a good spending plan. You know you have a problem when Leo X in the 1510s, just as Martin Luther is first getting his start, more than doubles the number of church offices that are being sold. I mean, it's just outright simony. There were at least three cardinals in the 1510s who held at least 11 simultaneous sees, episcopal sees, and were drawing the income from all of them. You're the bishop of 11 dioceses. Hey, there's a way to increase your income, right? Yeah, I know. I see the raised eyebrows. I know it's the past is not what we wish it was. That's why history is such a hard discipline. There are nasty struggles between parish clergy and members of religious orders and within religious orders. Those who want to reform the order and those who don't. In the 15th century, for example, the observant movement. Those members of religious orders who want to go back to the beginning ideals of the Franciscan or the Dominican or the Benedictine order or the Augustinians. There are other members of the order like, no, man, we like it how it is. Don't make things harder. Don't make things harder. So it introduces disagreements within religious orders as a result of the desire to reform. So, summing up this bit, in different ways, different places, over time, the Middle Ages is riven with all kinds of tensions and contestations and conflicts. There are different kinds of conflicts and problems from those that are characteristic of the modern era. But you don't have to read very much serious history about the Middle Ages to learn that this was an era replete with many difficulties. And nowhere was it more obvious or was it more commented upon between the 11th and the 15th centuries than with respect to the church itself. Constant calls for reform. Bernard of Clairvaux in the 12th century, Francis of Assisi in the 13th century, Catherine of Siena in the 14th century, Jean Gerson in the 15th century, Erasmus in the early 16th century, and I could quintuple the names from each of those centuries. They're calling for reform because there are so many problems. So, interim conclusion. Neither of these mirror image caricatures of the Middle Ages is really worthy of the period. They're not near the mark, even though both of them contain some elements of the truth, at least based on surviving sources and our best interpretations of the evidence, and that's how historians build up the picture of the past that we do. This was a deeply hierarchical society, was one pervaded by Christian ideals, assumptions, and institutions, but it was not one, not a world in which those ideals were fully, by any means, or always even obviously or observably realized. It was a world of material scarcity and of natural vulnerability, but it was not one that for its time and based on what was known and a technologically stunted or an anti-intellectual society, even though the vast majority of the population was illiterate and had no formal education. Then again, in a world peopled mostly by agricultural laborers, Who else would have done the work necessary to produce the food that was required for survival if they'd all been studying instead? You need a lot, these are just basic things to think about. You need a lot of steady, reliable agricultural surplus that's sustained year after year in any society in order to even aspire to something like universal education. And that's why it doesn't even really start to gain traction either in European countries or North America until the 19th century. So, the Middle Ages is best understood, I think, on the terms of its own protagonists, the people that lived through it, from the 6th century through the 15th, allowing for, acknowledging vast differences between Iceland and Sicily, right? Between England and Italy. It's not all of a piece any more than later European history is, recognizing many changes, developments over time. You know, nothing stops us from looking at the past, applying our own values, beliefs, and commitments to the Middle Ages or any other period. You're always free to do that. But if we do it, I mean, be prepared. Guess what you're going to see back? A reflection of your own values, beliefs, and commitments. That's exactly what you're going to get back if that's what you bring to the study of the past. It's not going to tell you anything about medieval men and women, what mattered to them, what it was like to live then, what human life and its experiences and its challenges meant to them. In order to try to get at that, we have to do at least two things, neither one of which is really easy. The first, be sufficiently aware enough of your own beliefs, values, and commitments, and then try our best to discipline ourselves to not impose them on the people that we're trying to understand. The Middle Ages, medieval Christianity, or the medieval church. And until and unless someone's willing to do that, willing and able to do it, we're not going to be able to move very far toward a properly historical understanding of the Middle Ages, or any other historical period for that matter. All right, I'm going to conclude now, just a few minutes. Oh, you're very patient, and I'm very verbose. Okay, let's wrap this up. Just a few minutes at the end here about what I think is going on with the use of these images, right? The cartoon, the Dark Ages cartoon, the Golden Age cartoon. I'm going to concentrate on the Dark Age cartoon because it's so much more pervasive. The other one is a kind of, it's sort of Catholic thing. You know, that's why I come to talk to Catholic students and say, better eschew that stereotype too. You know, because we're about the truth. Truth is the overriding category. Stick with that, you're always in good shape. Okay. To grow up in the early 21st century in the United States or in Canada or in a Western European country is to absorb, almost by kind of cultural osmosis, without realizing it, a basic narrative about change over time, over the long term. What French historians called la longue durée, right? The long durée. That narrative is based on a very sophisticated historical binary. It looks like this. And I'm going to reverse this. So this is further back in time for you guys, right? Arrow of time is going like this for you, right? Okay, so this is the Middle Ages. Over here, we have this. Medieval, backward, oppressive, superstitious, religious, bad. And over here, we have modern, enlightened, liberated, rational, secular, good. Okay, what more does one need to know? That's the basic bedrock framework. That's what we're all enculturated into and absorb without even realizing it. The narrative from medieval to modern, culminating in us, is always a narrative of progress. It's about how superstitious, oppressed, benighted, primitively religious medieval Europeans struggling to survive as village peasants eventually developed and progressed into enlightened, liberated, autonomous, secular, modern Westerners equipped with smartphones and globally connected via Facebook chatter and Snapchat. The history of the world. We're supposed to stick to this basic binary that underlies the narrative of progress, even if we nuance it, even if we can see that, I'll give you the Cathedral of Notre Dame in Paris is pretty nice. Medieval ivories and gold reliquaries are impressive, and if you push me, I'd say Aquinas was pretty smart. But what we're not supposed to do is to question the basic binary or the narrative that underlies it, or, for example, the displacement that has largely occurred since the 17th century, the displacement of divine providence, understood in Christian terms, with material progress, understood in secular terms. The basic message is that the world is getting better and better. Just in case you're being sort of distracted by a few things that have been going on in the world in the last couple years, just look at Steven Pinker's book. He's got all the graphs to reassure you everything's getting better. Whoever doubts it should look around. Look at the cool technology. Look at the amazing trips you can go on if you have enough money. Look at the medical innovations that are able to prolong life more and more, how great it is to live in a world in which we're free to believe whatever we want to buy as much as we want of whatever we want, and to do as we please without regard for anyone else, the culmination of human history. It's not surprising that we're all enculturated into this view of history, this view of change over time, before we ever take a history class, before we ever read a history book, wherever we study history in grade school. It's the cultural air that we breathe. And it's also the result of centuries of cultural layering that has denigrated and depended on criticizing the Middle Ages in order to make life since then look the better by contrast. Whether we're talking about Renaissance humanists themselves. They're the ones, after all, that invent the notion of the Middle Ages as a period of decline between the apex of human cultural achievement in the ancient world and its renewal and restoration in modern times, that is, the 15th century. What gets left out? The Middle Ages. That's when everything went to hell as far as classical Latin knowledge of Greek and ancient culture. Or the Protestant Reformation, another layer denigrating the Middle Ages, insisting on the rediscovery of the gospel after centuries of these medieval pagan philosophies had corrupted Christianity, clerical manipulations had distorted it, and unbiblical superstitions had laid it low. Or another layering, the Enlightenment in the 17th and the 18th centuries, with autonomous reason as the basis for morality, political life, society, prosperity, after centuries of medieval ignorance, superstition, and the age of religious warfare in the Reformation period. Follow that up by 19th century industrialization and the worship of science in the 19th century. The understanding of nature via science leads to the applications via technology, leads to human enjoyment and happiness, in contrast to that horrible period of deprived medieval poverty and suffering. And finally, of course, the culmination of universal history, the United States, American individualism. Religious freedom and self-determination as an extension of and a transplanting of the Protestant Reformation. Determining for yourself what's true for you against the tyranny of popery. What's with the Catholics? They're giving over their free will to determine the truth for themselves to this guy in Rome. What's with that? The image of the Middle Ages that is the most common today is a kind of complicated, built-up layering of this negative caricature. It's an amalgam of rehashed, repeated rejections that intersect, that reinforce one another, and that have been at work in one way or another since the 15th century. So it's no wonder that they're deeply rooted. When the image is invoked, usually with a polemical intent, it's, for example, implicitly at least, sometimes explicitly, to trumpet modern individual freedom, self-determination as good in contrast with the Middle Ages, when everyone was supposed to believe the same thing and was punished when they didn't. Low marks for diversity there, right? Actually, Western Europe and the Middle Ages are much more diverse in really interesting ways than it is now. Or it's to get us to try and ooh and ah about our incredible technology and capacity to master nature as unequivocally a good thing in contrast to the Middle Ages, when people were so sadly at the mercy of natural forces that they couldn't control. Or it's, for example, to remind ourselves about how blessed we are to have the separation of church and state, with religion as a private, personal matter in a secular public sphere, rather than religion as an organizing principle of a publicly shared culture and a common society. So the Middle Ages here is functioning as a kind of foil to defend modern values like liberalism, self-determination, secularism, modern materialism. It's being used to defend ideologies like secularism and scientism and capitalist consumerism. And it's being used to defend commitments to the power of technology, to capitalist acquisitiveness as transformative of human lives, supposedly always for the better. My last point, you know, it just seems to me, and this I come back again to knowledge and awareness of history, it seems to me that the history of the world in the 20th century, with our best estimates are at least 190 million people killed in its brutal recurrent wars and genocides, you'd think that that would have been sufficient to disabuse more people of naive narratives of historical progress and the basic binary that lies underneath it. And it's not just the 20th century, you know? You'd think the combination of concerns about global warming, recurrent wars, an estimated at least 60 million refugees in the world right now, the millions of lives being destroyed through human trafficking, even as we sit here, right, at Tulane this evening, the resurgence of authoritarian politics around the world, and indeed our own national political situation, you'd think it would be sufficient to inspire more nuanced views of change over time. just a slightly more differentiated assessment of what different historical periods and peoples and civilizations have done well and what they've done not so well, including not only the modern era and our own times, but also the Middle Ages. They weren't all darkness, and our times are far from all light. Thank you.